What I wanted to talk to you today about is failure. Failure stings. I hate failure. I hate losing. It bothers me. Failure, here's an example of failure. Failure is if you are a football team from a state north of here, okay? And let's say last season was an embarrassment. And so all off season and then all of this season, you call it your revenge tour, all right? And you're going to go and you're going to just womp all the teams that beat you last year. And then at the very end of that revenge tour, when you play your rival, you get embarrassed on national television. That is failure. And everyone in Michigan knows what failure is today. Failure's worst, it's at its worst, when you tout victory before it happens, and then you lose. Victory's great when you say you're gonna win ahead of time and you go out and you do it, right? You ever call your shot before? And then you win? It feels good, right? You kind of get a little, you know, strut a little bit, all that. But it's worse when you say you're gonna win. When you say you're gonna show up. And you just get your tail whipped. You get it handed to you. Peter's words before Jesus was crucified. In front of his friends, in front of the other disciples, he says this, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." Even if everyone else deserts you, I never will. Imagine that. And that's not just one-on-one to Jesus. They're not alone, isolated from the other disciples. And he says, you know what, Jesus, I've always got your back. No, he says it in front of the other ones. He says, you know what? These other 11, they might turn tail and run. They're a bunch of cowards probably, but not me. Not me, Jesus. If they come to kill you like you keep talking about, they come for you, they got to take both of us. We'll be back to back. I'll fight with you the whole way. No matter what happens, you can count on me. That's what he's saying. And then that day comes. And the woman comes up to Peter and she says, "Aren't you one of his disciples? Haven't I seen you with Jesus?" "Not me. You've got the wrong guy." And then on the hill, as Jesus is crucified, and you look around at the scene, there's some Pharisees, there's his mother, there's probably his aunt, there's another disciple, but it's not Peter, it's John. Where's Peter? We don't know, but he's not there. And there's two other guys crucified next to Jesus, and neither of them are Peter. So much for all those words, right? So much for talking a tough game. So much for being everything you thought you were. For as brave as he thought he would be, when it came down to it, he was a coward, and he couldn't live up to what he claimed. So in John 21, we have an interesting scene. Now, Jesus has appeared to the disciples twice, okay? But we've never seen this interaction between Jesus and Peter during this time. This has never been addressed. "Hey, Peter, remember how you said if they come to kill me and they're going to crucify me, that they're going to crucify you too? Hey, Peter, do you remember when you said, even if the other 11 desert me, that I could count on you and you would be right there the whole time? Do you remember that? Let's talk about that." We never get that conversation in those first two times. And the truth is, we don't really need that conversation. So Peter is out fishing. And what do you do when you've got a lot on your mind? You go and you do something you're familiar with, right? You do something you're comfortable with. Take your mind off things or help sort things out. And so Peter tells the disciples one morning, he goes, I'm going to go fishing. And they say, you know what, we'll come with you. And they're out about 100 yards from shore. And there's a man on the beach. And he says, friends, he calls out to him across the water. He says, friends, haven't you any fish? And they look to the shore. And they don't have to say anything. They know who it is. They know it's Jesus on the shore calling out to them. And he says, you know, cast your net over the right side of the boat. It's a familiar scene from just a few years ago for these men. And they cast their net over the boat. And I think that this time around, when Jesus tells them to cast the net over, I think they know what's coming. And there's all these fish. And it's so many fish, they can't haul them up into the boat. They're going to have to tow them back to shore. And so Peter, remember, it's Peter's idea, first of all, to go out fishing, right? And then they have all these fish, and the disciples can't pull them up into the boat. They don't have enough manpower. And so Peter, being a good friend, just leaves them there and jumps into the water and swims to shore. And leaves all the other disciples to, hey, I'll see you when I see you guys. And when the disciples get to shore, Peter's there at a fire with Jesus. And Jesus has some bread, and Jesus has some fish that he's grilling up. He's cooking them breakfast. Now imagine the shame and the guilt of Peter. I wish I could have been there in those minutes before the disciples got the boat back that 100 or so yards. Did Peter and Jesus talk? Or was it more just silence? I think it was silence. You ever have to apologize for something? And you know you were wrong? Like you are really wrong. Like, it's not like, hey, you know, like you're going to apologize and you're going to hope they say, oh, no, it was okay. Like, you're going to apologize. You're just like, yeah, I royally messed up. And the person you're apologizing to knows you messed up. And you know that they know how bad you messed up. You know what I'm talking about? You just got your tail between your legs. I think that's what's going on with Peter. The tension has to be thick, right, as they eat breakfast. Peter just, I should say something to him. I should tell him I'm sorry. No, that won't be enough. What can I say? Imagine those thoughts going through his head. What can I possibly do to make up for leaving my friend alone to die? All the pain he went through, I saw it, or some of it. And I told him I'd be there with him. And gosh, if I could go back and do it again, I think that this time I'd have the courage to do it. But the reality is, and Peter knows it, he only had one shot. And he blew it. And he didn't follow through on his promise. He didn't come through with what he told Jesus he would do. And he doesn't know what to tell him. And so Jesus breaks the ice. And he asked Peter a question. If you have your Bibles, look at John 21, verse 15. We have this kind of interesting interaction. And it says, when they had finished eating, Jesus says to Simon Peter, he says, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? He says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. So Jesus tells him, feed my lambs. Verse 16, again, Jesus said, he says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Now Peter answers, he says, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. So Jesus says, take care of my sheep. And then the third time, Jesus says to him, he says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? It says here, Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." So Jesus tells him, "Feed my sheep." Verse 18, "Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." That last few sentences is kind of cryptic. What he's telling Peter, he says, you know, you're a young man and you dress yourself and you go where you want to go. But when you're an old man, someone else is going to dress you and they're going to stretch out your arms. They're going to take you to a place you don't want to go. What he's telling him is, Peter, you're young now and you can do what you want. But when you get older, there's going to come a day where you might not want to do something, but you're going to do it anyways. And you're going to go with people. They're going to put you to death, and they're going to stretch out your arms. What he's telling Peter is, one day, when you're an old man, you're going to be crucified. Peter, you told me just a few days ago, just as we were coming into Jerusalem, that if they came to kill and crucify me, they'd have to kill and crucify you. And I'm telling you, you didn't live up to those words. But one day, when you're an old man, you will. And you're going to die. And then he says this, "Follow me." Those words he said to Peter 3 years before, when he called him to be his disciple, those are the key words. When a teacher went and looked for his disciples, he would go to them, and he'd already talked to them once or a couple of times, and he had quizzed them, and he had had these long discussions with them about Scripture and about God. And teachers would look for their disciples, and there were more people that wanted to become disciples than were going to make the cut. All right? And Jesus goes up to Peter one day, 3 years before this, and he says, "Follow me, come be my disciple. Live life with me for as long as I'll have you. Learn from me. Be like me." And he's asking him to do that again. And this time he's giving him kind of a qualifying thing. "You follow me this time, you will die. It will be the death of you." Imagine that, right? Imagine, you know, at end of service today, I say, "Hey, you know, right, I'm starting up this ministry, and I'm going to plant this church, and we're going to do a bunch of cool stuff. I'd love you to come. I need a guy to do, you know, A, B, and C. By the way, if you follow me, they're going to kill you." Do you just say, "Yeah, sign me up"? Yeah, you do. You know, we miss something here in this talk with Jesus and Peter. If you've ever read this before, you hear a sermon on it, and you're like, Jesus keeps asking Peter if he loves him, and Peter keeps saying, "Yeah, you know I love you," and then it's like almost like Jesus isn't satisfied because he keeps asking him again, and then he asks him a third time. You ever have that feeling when you read this? The language John wrote this in, you know, obviously wasn't English. It was in Greek, and they have all these words for love. We have one word for love. And you just kind of know what people mean when they say they love something, right? I really loved my Thanksgiving meal I had on Friday. It was great. I also love my wife. You know I mean two different things, right? And if I meant the same thing, you would think he doesn't love his wife very much, or he has a very unhealthy relationship with Thanksgiving meals. This language, when they meant something different for love, they just used a different word. And so when Jesus asked Peter the first time if he loves him, he uses this word, agape, which is kind of an all-encompassing love, an unconditional love. It doesn't matter what you do, I still love you, love. And Jesus asked Peter, "Do you love me unconditionally?" And Peter looks at Jesus and he says, Lord, you know I love you like a brother, or like a close friend. That word's phileos. That's why we call Philadelphia the city of brotherly love. It comes from that word. You see, Peter would like to say, I love you unconditionally, but he can't. And just a few days before this interaction, he probably would have told Jesus, I love you unconditionally, because he told him, I love you so much, even if everyone else deserts you, and they come to torture and kill you, in just the worst way imaginable, you can count on me to be there. That's an unconditional love. And that's the love Peter claimed to have had, and that's the love he thought he had. But now Peter realizes, I don't love Jesus unconditionally, I just love him like a close friend. He's my brother. So Jesus asks him a second time, Peter, do you love me unconditionally? And Peter again, can you imagine his heart just sinking? That feeling in his stomach of, gosh, Jesus is asking me if I love him unconditionally, and I thought I did, but the truth is, I don't. My love was put to the test, and it failed. But I do love him like a brother. And he tells him that again. You know, I love you like a brother. And Jesus says, take care of my sheep. Now, the third time, Jesus changes something. And he looks at Peter, and when he asks him if he loves him, he says, do you love me like a brother? He uses that phileos word. Peter says, you know all things. You know I love you like a brother. You know that's how I love you, Jesus. What he's telling Jesus, he says, you know what, I'm not going to lie to you. You know the truth, and I know the truth now. And the reality is Jesus knew the truth before Peter did, right? When Peter made all those claims, Jesus knew Peter's heart. And he knew he didn't love him that way. But he tells him this. You know, after he says, you know, it's all right, you love me like a brother, you know? There's still sheep to feed. That's when he tells him, one day, Peter, there'll be an old man, and people will dress you, and they'll stretch out your arms. They'll put you to death. Come and follow me. What he's telling Peter is this. You follow after me. You might love me like a brother now, but at the end of this, by the time you're an old man, you'll love me unconditionally. You'll love me the way I want you to love me. You'll love me the way you hope to love me. It might just take a while. Ray, you like candy bars? It's Milky Way. You'll settle for Milky Way. You want a bite? That end? You can have that end. You sure? Why not? It's really good. Yeah, you see where I'm going with that. How about this one? It is good. It hasn't been opened or anything. But this is the one I'm offering you. You sure? I've warmed it up for you pretty much. Mm-hmm. You see, the love Jesus calls us to is a lot like this candy bar. You don't always want it. The love where we're at and what we're comfortable with is like this one. And I know for some of you that have been here a while and have been through the ups and downs that come with a church that's been around for a while, and you've seen pastors come and go and people come and go and things change for the better and sometimes for the worse. that sometimes you take a bite of this one and you don't always like it, but you know that it's for the best. We want to love Jesus like a brother. And he'll take that. But what he calls you to in life is to take a bite of this one. Anytime you're ready for it, just let me know. But you know what the good thing is? Jesus is all right with where you're at. If you're willing to go a little further. If you're willing to follow him. He doesn't say to Peter, you know what? You failed. You said you loved me unconditionally, and that's what I want from you, so come back when you do. Doesn't tell Peter that. He says, hey, you love me like a brother. You don't love me unconditionally. You don't love me to the point where you will give anything and everything to follow me. But one day you will, and I will get you there. But you just have to start following me now and take a step and then another step. And before you know it, you're a long ways down the road. This is at the core. We say this in Wesleyan churches a lot. This is word holiness. What does that even mean? That's what it is. Is we're here and Jesus wants us to be here. And he says, follow me. And we go, okay, I don't think I can make it all the way real fast, but I think I can take a step. And then maybe next week or next month, Jesus, you can have me take another step. And I'm gonna keep taking tiny little steps until you get me to where you want me to be. When you invite Jesus into your life, it's like having your house remodeled, all right? A lot of times people, they come to Christ, they start coming to church and they're not even Christians. You're just kind of like, well, maybe I should go to church here. Because part of your life, let's be honest, just sucks, all right? You're bottomed out somewhere in life. You know, your job, your kids, your spouse, you know, whatever it is. And you come to Jesus and you say, this, I don't know what to do anymore. I'm out of options. You been there before? That's how a lot of people come to know Jesus. They're out of options. They're bottomed out. Rock bottom. And Jesus says, great. Let me come in and fix up that part of your life and bring some real life to it, all right? It's like if you're having your house remodeled and you invite somebody to come in, just fix up your kitchen. My kitchen's a mess. You know what, the rest of the house is fine, but my kitchen, it's just a disaster. And I need new cabinets and counters and floors, and you know what, the appliances, they gotta go. Those are outdated, and you just got a lot of work to do. Now imagine coming home one day, and the worker's there, and instead of just, the kitchen's done, and then he knocked down the back wall, and there's an extension going up, and there's a new deck off to the side of the house, and there's all the scaffolding up there. And he says, you know what? I think we're going to just tear the roof off. We're going to add another story. That's what Jesus does to a life. He comes in just to fix one thing. And he says, you know what? I'm not all right with that. I got a lot of other things that I think would be good here. But you gotta trust me. And it's uncomfortable having all that work done sometimes. And you don't always see where it's going. But when it's done, it looks great. You guys ever watch HGTV? My wife loves HGTV. She's probably got it on right now at home. Like, guaranteed, there's probably a Fixer Upper marathon going on right now on HGTV, and it is playing in the background. And like midway through these like renovations, you know what I'm talking about? Like the couple comes into the house and they look like horrified and they're like, this is horrible. Like we just gave all this money to these people and this thing is just a disaster and there's no way this is gonna look good, right? And then like it's like the big reveal at the end, you know, and they like move the things away and they're like, oh my gosh. Like, yeah, you haven't seen the show before? Like it always looks nice at the end. That's like our lives. Jesus comes in and your life is a mess and he keeps asking you to take a few steps to trust him a little bit more. Hey, do this thing I'm calling you to. You ever have that feeling? It's like Jesus is sitting down like right behind you in church sometimes and he's like whispering in your ear and poking your shoulder, right? He's like, hey, Ray, you need to take a bite of that Milky Way that looks disgusting. I know you don't want to do it, but you got to do it. Trust me. Trust me. I can't tell you what it's going to look like at the end, but trust me, just do this. That's what Jesus is like. What Peter's learning in this scene is that this stuff in life isn't really that important, but this stuff in life is. And that's a tough thing to do. It's a tough pill to swallow. It's what Solomon is talking about when he writes Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament, and you open that book and you look through it, and just verse after verse, he keeps coming back to this same point, and he says, meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. It's a chasing after the wind, all right? Solomon is a guy that if we were to take his wealth and kind of convert it to today's dollars, he's maybe somewhere around like $180 billion, all right? That would put him far into the wealth. It's like three times more money than the wealthiest person on the planet. This guy had anything he wanted. All right? And you read about Solomon's life, and you see he tried out a bunch of things to fill up his life with. And you know what? He looks at his kingdom, and he looks at this huge palace of his, and he looks at all the stuff he has, and I'm sure it was all nice. And I'm sure there were times where it brought him a lot of joy and a lot of pleasure. But he says, you know what? All of this stuff is meaningless compared to this stuff. And that's the lesson Peter's learning. Peter was at a point just a few days before this scene where this stuff was a little bit more important than this stuff. And Jesus says, hey, I'm not going to beat you over the head for that. But if you follow me, I'll get you to the point, Peter, where this stuff is all that matters, and you will sacrifice all of this for this. And you'll do it with a smile. Jim Elliot was a missionary to a group of people named the Harani, that many of whom are Christians now. They killed Jim. And Jim was said he was a people called him an idiot for going to these kind of these people that didn't have a lot of contact. They had some contact with Christians, but not a lot. And in his journal, not too long before his death, he wrote, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. The love Jesus calls us to for him is risky. It is dangerous at times and scary at times to let go of the old and welcome the new. And this is a story as old as time. It's a story we can see in our lives, and we can look through the Bible and see story after story of Jesus, of God calling people to leave the old behind into something that's a little bit unknown. He doesn't tell them everything that's going to happen in their lives in the future if they follow him. He just says, follow me. And in the end, it'll be good for you. In the end, you'll love me unconditionally. And this, you'll find, is so much better than anything here. He says this to Abraham, right? When we meet Abraham in Genesis, he's an old man that's living in his mom's basement. It's the best way I've heard him put. He has not left home yet. He's not just a grown man, he's an old man, all right? And God comes to him and he says, leave your father's house. And he essentially tells him, come with me into an unknown land filled with unknown people. And I'm going to be your God. And all of your descendants, you won't be able to count them. But I'm not going to tell you all the steps between here and there. You just got to trust me. When he calls Moses to go back into Egypt to free the Israelites, Moses is also an old man. Moses is 80 years old. And he stutters And God's telling him, I want you to go to the Pharaoh, who's the most powerful person in the world at the time, and ask for the freedom of your people. How do you think Moses thought that was going to work out for him? When he calls Jeremiah to be a prophet, Jeremiah says, you know what, I'm too young. But all right, I'll come anyways, if you call me. And then throughout that call, for 40 years, Jeremiah, he ministers to a bunch of people that don't want to listen to him, and he doesn't have anybody convert. 31. I can't imagine being 71 and not having like one conversion as a pastor. 40 years. I wonder if there were times where Jeremiah, along this way, when God keeps asking him, take a step and then another step and keep following me, and he does that for 40 years, if somewhere along the line he said, you know what? Did I misread what God was telling me? Am I going the right direction? God, I keep taking a bite of this one, this nasty, disgusting one that you keep asking me to, and I just don't see the results. And there's Amos. Israel's had a civil war, and there's two kingdoms now. There's one in the south, and there's one in the north, and Amos is in the south. And God calls him to be a prophet to the northern kingdom. And Amos's resume is that he takes care of fig trees, all right? And he's going to go talk to a bunch of people about God. God's calling him to take a big step there, right? If any one of these people could stand right here today and we could ask him, you know what? Was taking a bite of this worth it? When you could have just settled for this one that was a lot nicer looking, a lot more comfortable, every one of them would say, you bet it was. If we could have any of those prophets of old, right? That's why I was reading in Hebrews just last month. I was reading through the book. In Hebrews 12:1, the writer says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders us. So sometimes when we have to take these steps in life and make these changes and let go of the old, whether it's with ourselves or with our church, we can remember that we are surrounded by this great cloud of people that have done it already. I was talking with my grandpa about this a few weeks ago, right? My grandpa's right over here. His dad traveled on a horse to a bunch of different churches around where he lived. It was their pastor. And so when I complain sometimes about driving across the state in a really nice car, like I just think like there's that great cloud of witnesses like calling me a wimp because he had to ride a horse. But it spurs you on when you remember everybody that came before you. And if God was there for all of them when they took those steps, he's going to be there for me when I take those steps. Mark 8:36, Jesus says some of the wisest words ever spoken. He says, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? And I wonder, as if Peter's life went on, if those words of Jesus came back to him when he spoke them that day. When Peter was tempted to go back to the more comfortable love, he still loves Jesus, just it's a little bit easier. It's not as risky. You don't have as much on the line. Those days came for Peter. Undoubtedly, they come for all of us, right? The days when you kind of just want to stay in bed when you should get out. Those spiritual days. And I wonder if on those days, if Peter remembered those words where Jesus looked at them and said, you know, what does it profit a man to gain all of this but lose this? Nothing. I'm going to close with this story. I told you, I drive a lot. When I drove up here a couple of times, it was nice. I had a partner with me. I had Aaron, and Aaron can talk. You guys learned that. Might be watching now. Yeah, you heard me. And that's fun. I enjoy that when I get to drive with somebody, you know. But I don't always, a lot of times I'm in the car alone. And my mind can kind of wander. And if you ever drive a lot, you realize, like, you know, I listen to, like, audiobooks, and I listen to music sometimes, and I listen to podcasts, but after a while, you just get sick of it. Like, you're just in the car a lot, and you just get sick of listening to stuff. And then what happens is you're there alone in your car, and you're driving, and you're just alone with your thoughts, which is a dangerous thing sometimes. And sometimes when I drive, I think of heaven. And I spend a lot of time thinking about heaven. And I wonder what the first few moments are like. And what I've kind of settled on is that no matter how great or beautiful of a picture I create in my head, it's going to fall really short. But it's still fun. And I like the beach, so I imagine there's a beach. And I like those beaches where there's like the wooden stairs and the tall grass, you know, at the back of the beach. And I imagine there's something like that. And there's a big field. And there's a forest in the distance. And maybe beyond that you can see some mountains poking up. I imagine the sun coming up over the water. And I imagine Jesus coming there. And it's like you know him before he even introduces himself. And Revelation tells me, he calls me by a name. He gives me a stone with my name on it. A name that's never been spoken to me before. But when I see that name and when he tells me that name, I know it's mine. I love the way this guy George MacDonald put it. He said, you know, this name Jesus is going to call you, he says you can't hear it until you've become the name. And what he means is when you're ready to take a bite of this, when holiness has happened, when you love him completely, unconditionally, when you've become who Jesus intended you to become, he calls you by a name and you go, that's me. That's who you wanted me to be. And I imagine Peter's first day in heaven. Those first few moments there. And we know from kind of legend, from church history, what his last few moments here was like. Peter, 33 years after this breakfast on the beach, was an old man. And he had disciples of his own, disciples that he had probably come to and said those same words that Jesus one day said to him, was come, follow me, be my disciple. And as an old man, Peter had been on the run sometimes. There are people that wanted to kill him. And he had escaped, you know, sometimes close calls, sometimes not so much. And one night his disciples come to him, they say, Peter, they're coming for you, they're going to kill you. Let's get you out of here. So they're sneaking him out of the city. And as they're about to leave the city, story goes that Peter looks and sees Jesus appear to him, and his disciples do not see Jesus. And Jesus tells him, no more running. Stay. And I wonder if right then, that day on the beach came back to him. One day, when you're an old man, people will come and they'll dress you. And they'll take you to a place you don't want to go and they'll stretch out your arms. And Peter knew, today's that day. Peter could have ran. Peter could have snuck out in the middle of the night with his disciples and lived another day. Might have lived another month, another 20 years, who knows? But there was a time 33 years before that, when Peter said, "Jesus, if I have to die with you, so be it. Even if everyone runs away, let them. You can count on me." And Jesus came to Peter, and he's an old man. He says, "It's time to stop running. It's time to die, like I told you you would." And Peter could have ran. And if he would have ran, he would have loved Jesus like a brother, just like he always had. But something had changed in Peter, and he didn't love Jesus just like a brother anymore. He loved him unconditionally. Peter had learned over those 33 years that this stuff, as nice as it is compared to heaven, it's just worthless. And so Peter stays. And Peter's taken into custody, and he's dressed by people. And they go to stretch out his arms. And when that time comes to crucify him, he says, "No. I don't deserve to die the same way Jesus died." And I think he said that because he had fallen short 3 decades before that. 33 years ago, when Peter was young, I think he would have been crucified the same way Jesus was. But he still carried that with him, I think. See, I fell short then, and I don't deserve to die the same way he did. And they say, "Fine. We're going to crucify you anyways," and they crucify him upside down. And he dies that way. And I wonder as life faded here and came to him in heaven, if Peter found himself on a beach like that one from 33 years before. And if when he woke up in heaven, he wakes up sitting on that beach and there's Jesus there sitting in the sand with a little fire and a little plate of fish and bread. And I like to think that Jesus looked at Peter and he asked him, he says, "Peter, do you love me unconditionally?" And Peter was able to finally say, "Lord, you know I do. I love you unconditionally. You promised me that you would get me there. And you did. You were true to your word." Here's the deal. Your church has been through a lot. And even if you haven't been here through all of it, hey, you're part of it. And each one of you has probably been through a lot. You have a teacher, he said, "I got stuff, you got stuff, all God's people got stuff." We all got baggage, right? And at some point in our relationship with God, we love him, but we don't love him as much as he'd like. And he doesn't write us off. So this conversation between you and God that you can have is this: "God, I know I'm not where you would like me to be. That's no secret. God knows it, I know it, you know it, right?" So you just ask God this: "You know what? What is the smallest possible step I can take to get me where you want me to be and to transform me?" All right? It doesn't have to be big and life-changing. We got New Year's coming around, you know, the corner, right? And we all make these, not all of us, but a lot of us make these, you know, big proclamations of stuff we're going to do. And it never works. We never stick with it. So don't do that same thing with you and God, because that never works. Like, I've been there. I've worked with people that have been there, and that, you know, you can try things. And you might not read your Bible, like, ever. And then January 1st, you're like, "I'm reading this whole thing twice this year." Yeah, right. That ain't going to happen. But maybe you say, "You know what? I bet I can read the Bible for 10 minutes every other day." That's like really easy, right? I can handle 10 minutes every other day. Like, let's be honest. Like, you probably are in the bathroom for 10 minutes sometimes. You can handle, pull out your phone, read the Bible. Real simple, right? It's a baby step. Ask God, "What's the smallest, what's the easiest step I can take? And then when I get there, show me the next one." And then one day you'll find yourself there on the beach in heaven with Jesus, reliving all the steps he had you take and how you learned heaven is so much better than everything else. Let's pray. God, thank you. Thanks for not leaving us high and dry when we aren't where we need to be. You're not a God that runs away. You're not a God that plays hide and seek. And God, I ask you to spur us on and to encourage us, to let us know that the smallest step is still a step. That you remove the anxieties of, gosh, we just got to get life together and we got to figure out everything all at once. That you remind us that you're a God that is here with us every step of the way. In your name we pray. Amen.